I press the button that flattens its head, leaving the table hovering over me like a vulture. Oh, wait, there's a control here that lowers the bed, too. Good. Now I can roll onto my side without hitting the damn table and spilling the porridge. Don't want to do that again. They may call it a display of temper and summon Dr. Rashid. Once my bed is flat and as low as it will go, I roll onto my side and stare out the Venetian blinds at the blue sky beyond. After a few minutes, I'm lulled into a sort of peace. The sky, same as it always was.
Chapter 9.
I'm daydreaming, staring out the open door at the sky when the brakes start their piercing shriek and everything lurches forward. I brace myself against the rough floor and then, after I regain my balance, run my hands through my hair and tie my shoes. We must have finally reached Joliet. The rough-hewn door beside me squeaks open, and Kinko comes out. He leans against the frame of the main door with Queenie at his feet, staring intently at the passing landscape. He hasn't looked at me since yesterday's incident, and to be frank, I find it difficult to look at him, vacillating as I do from feeling the deepest empathy for his mortification to being barely able not to laugh. When the train finally chugs to a stop and sighs, Kinko and Queenie disembark with the usual clap-clap and flying leap. The scene outside is eerily quiet. Although the flying squadron pulled in a good half hour ahead of us, its men stand around silently. There is no ordered chaos. There is no clatter of runs or chutes, no cursing, no flying coils of rope, no hitching of teams. There are simply hundreds of disheveled men staring in bafflement at the pitched tents of another circus. It's like a ghost town. There's a big top, but no crowd. Cookhouse, but no flag. Wagons and dressing tents fill the back end, but the people who are left mill about aimlessly or sit idly in the shade. I jump down from the stock car just as a black and beige Plymouth Roadster pulls into the parking lot. Two men in suits climb out, carrying briefcases and scanning the scene from under Homburg's. Uncle Al strides toward them, sans entourage, wearing his top hat and swinging his silver-tipped cane. He shakes hands with both men, his face jovial, cordial. As he talks, he turns to gesture broadly across the lot. The businessmen nod, crossing their arms in front of them, figuring, considering. I hear gravel crunching behind me, and then August appears at my shoulder. "That's our Al," he says. "He can smell a city official a mile off. You watch. He'll have the mayor eating out of his hand by noon." He claps me on the shoulder. "Come on." "Where to?" I ask. "Into town for breakfast," he says. "Doubt there's any food here. Probably won't be until tomorrow." "Jesus, really?" "Well, we'll try. But we hardly gave the advance man time to get here, did we?"
"What about them?"
"Who?"
I point at the defunct circus.
"Them? When they get hungry enough, they'll mope off. Best thing for everyone, really."
"And our guys?"
"Oh, them. They'll survive until something shows up. Don't you worry. Al won't let them die."
We stop at a diner not far down the main strip. It has booths along one wall, and a laminate counter with red-topped stools along the other. A handful of men sit at the counter, smoking and chatting with the girl who stands behind it. I hold the door for Marlena, who goes immediately to a booth and slides in against the wall. August drops onto the opposite bench, so I end up sitting next to her. She crosses her arms and stares at the wall.
"Morning, what can I get you folks?"
says the girl, still behind the counter.
"The works," says August. "I'm famished."
"How do you like your eggs?"
"Sunny side up."
"Ma'am?" "Just coffee,"
Marlena says, sliding one leg over the other and jiggling her foot. The motion is frenetic, almost aggressive. She does not look at the waitress, or August, or me, come to think of it.
Sir?
Says the girl. Same as him, I say. Thanks. August leans back and pulls out a pack of Camels. He flicks the bottom. A cigarette arcs through the air. He catches it in his lips and leans back, eyes bright, hands spread in triumph. Marlena turns to look at him. She claps slowly, deliberately, her face stony.
Come on now, darling. Don't be a wet noodle, says August. You know we were out of meat.
Excuse me, she says, sliding toward me. I leap out of her way.
She marches out the door, shoes tap-tapping, and hips swaying under her flared red dress.
Women,
says August, lighting his cigarette from behind a cupped hand. He snaps his lighter shut.
Oh, sorry. Want one?
No, thanks, I don't smoke.
No,
he muses, sucking in a lungful.
You should take it up. It's good for your health.
He puts the pack back in his pocket and snaps his fingers at the girl behind the counter. She's standing at the griddle, holding a spatula.
Make it snappy, would you? We don't have all day.
She freezes, spatula in the air. Two of the men at the counter turn slowly to look at us, eyes wide. August, I say.
What?
He looks genuinely puzzled.
It's coming just as fast as I can make it,
the waitress says coldly.
Fine. That's all I was asking, says August.
He leans toward me and continues in a lowered voice.
What did I tell you? Women. Must be a full moon or something.
When I return to the lot, a selected few of the Benzini brothers' tents are up. The menagerie, the stable tent, and the cookhouse. The flag is flying and the smell of sour grease permeates the air.
Don't even bother, says a man coming out. Fried dough and nothing but chicory to wash it down.
Thanks, I say. I appreciate the warning. He spits and stalks off. The Fox Brothers employees who remain are lined up in front of the privilege car. A desperate hopefulness surrounds them. A few smile and joke, but their laughter is high-pitched. Some stare straight ahead, their arms crossed. Others fidget and pace with bowed heads. One by one, they're summoned inside for an audience with Uncle Al. The majority climb out defeated. Some wipe their eyes and confer quietly with others near the front of the line. Others stare stoically ahead before walking toward town. Two dwarves enter together. They leave a few minutes later, grim-faced, pausing to talk to a small group of men. Then they trudge down the tracks, side by side, heads high, stuffed pillowcases slung over their shoulders. I scan the crowd for the famous freak. There are certainly oddities, dwarves and midgets and giants, a bearded lady. Al's already got one, so she's probably out of luck. An enormously fat man could get lucky if Al wants a matching set, and an assortment of generally sad-looking people and dogs. But no man with an infant sticking out of his chest. After Uncle Al has made his selections, our workmen tear down all the other circus tents except for the stable and menagerie. The remaining Fox Brothers men, no longer on anyone's payroll, sit and watch, smoking and spitting wads of tobacco juice into tall patches of Queen Anne's lace and thistles. When Uncle Al discovers that city officials have yet to itemize the Fox Brothers' baggage stock, a handful of nondescript horses get spirited from one stable tent to another. Absorption, so to speak. And Uncle Al's not the only one with that idea. A handful of farmers hang around the edges of the lot, trailing lead ropes.
They're just going to walk out of here with them? I ask Pete.
Probably, he says. Don't bother me none as long as they don't touch ours. Keep your eyes open, though. It's going to be a day or two before anyone knows what's what, and I don't want none of ours going missing.
Our baggage stock has done double duty, and the big horses are foaming and blowing hard. I persuade a city official to open a hydrant so we can water them, but they're still without hay or oats. August returns as we're filling the last trough.
What the hell are you doing? Those horses have been on a train for 3 days. Get out there on the pavement and hard-ass them so they don't go soft.
Hard-ass my ass, replies Pete. Look around you. Just what the hell do you think they've been doing for the last 4 hours?
You used our stock?
What the hell do you want me to use?
You should have used their baggage stock.
I don't know their fucking baggage stock, shouts Pete. And what's the point of using their baggage stock if we're just going to have to hard-ass ours to keep them in shape anyway?
August's mouth opens, then it shuts, and he disappears. Before long, trucks converge on the lot. One after another backs up to the cookhouse, and unbelievable amounts of food disappear behind it. The cookhouse crew gets right to work, and in no time at all, the boiler is running and the scent of good food, real food, wafts across the lot. The food and bedding for the animals arrives shortly thereafter, in wagons rather than trucks. When we cart the hay into the stable tent, the horses nicker and rumble and stretch out their necks, snatching mouthfuls before it even hits the ground. The animals in the menagerie are no less happy to see us. The chimps scream and swing from the bars of their dens, flashing toothy grins. The meat eaters pace. The hay burners toss their heads, snorting, squealing, and even barking in agitation. I open the orangutan's door and set a pan of fruits, vegetables, and nuts on the floor. As I close it, her long arm reaches through the bars. She points at an orange in another pan.
That? You want that?
She continues to point, blinking at me with close-set eyes. Her features are concave, her face a wide platter fringed with red hair. She's the most outrageous, beautiful thing I've ever seen. Here, I say, handing her the orange. You can have it. She takes it and sets it on the floor. Then she reaches out again. After several seconds of serious misgivings, I hold out my hand. She wraps her long fingers around it, then lets go. She sits on her haunches and peels her orange. I stare in amazement. She was thanking me.
So that's that, says August as we emerge from the menagerie.
He claps a hand on my shoulder.
Join me for a drink, my boy. There's lemonade in Marlena's dressing tent, and not that sock juice from the juice joint either. We'll put a drop of whiskey in, hey, hey.
I'll be along in a minute, I say. I need to check the other menagerie. Because of the peculiar status of the Fox Brothers' baggage stock, whose numbers have been depleting all afternoon, I've seen for myself that they were fed and watered, but I have yet to lay eyes on their exotics or ring stock.
No, August says firmly. You'll join me now.
I look over, surprised by his tone. All right, sure, I say. Do you know if they got fed and watered?
They'll get fed and watered eventually.
What? I say.
They'll get fed and watered eventually.
August is damn near 90 degrees. We can't leave them without at least water.
We can and we will. It's how Uncle Al does business. He and the mayor will play chicken for a while. The mayor will figure out he doesn't have a fucking clue what to do with giraffes and zebras and lions. He'll drop his prices, and then, and only then, we'll move in.
I'm sorry, but I can't do that, I say, turning to walk away. His hand locks around my arm. He comes in front of me and leans in so close his face is inches from mine. He lays a finger alongside my cheek.
Yes, you can. They will be cared for. Just not yet. That's how it works.
That's bullshit.
Uncle Al has made an art form out of building this circus. We are what we are because of it. Who the hell knows what's in that tent? If there's nothing he wants, then fine. Who cares? But if there's something he wants, and you mess with his business, and he ends up paying more because of it, you better believe that Al is going to mess with you. Do you understand?
He speaks through clenched teeth.
Do you understand?
He repeats, coming to a full stop after each word. I stare straight into his unblinking eyes. Entirely, I say.
Good,
he says. He takes his finger out of my face and steps backward.
Good,
he says again, nodding and allowing his face to relax. He forces a laugh.
I'll tell you what, that whiskey will go down well.
I think I'll pass. He watches me for a moment and then shrugs.
Suit yourself,
he says. I take a seat some distance from the tent housing the abandoned animals, watching it with increasing desperation. The sidewall billows inward with a sudden gust of wind. There isn't even a cross-draft. I have never been more aware of the heat beating down on my own head and the dryness of my own throat. I remove my hat and wipe a gritty arm across my forehead. When the orange and blue flag goes up over the cookhouse for dinner, a handful of new Benzini Brothers employees join the lineup, identifiable by the red dinner tickets they clutch in their hands. The fat man was lucky, as was the bearded lady and a handful of dwarves. Uncle Al took on only performers, although one unfortunate fellow found himself unemployed again within a matter of minutes when August caught him looking a little too appreciatively at Marlena as he exited the privilege car. A few others try to join the lineup, and not a one of them gets by Ezra. His only job is to know everyone on the show, and by God, he's good at it. When he jerks his thumb at some unfortunate, Blackie steps forward to take care of it. One or two of the rejects manage to scarf a fistful of food before flying headfirst out of the cookhouse. Drab, silent men hang all around the perimeter with hungry eyes. As Marlena steps away from the steam tables, one of them addresses her. He's a tall man, gaunt with deeply creased cheeks. Under different circumstances, he would probably be handsome.
Lady. Hey, lady. Can you spare a little? Just a piece of bread.
Marlena stops and looks at him. His face is hollow. His eyes desperate. She looks at her plate.
Oh, come on, lady. Have a heart. I ain't ate in 2 days.
He runs his tongue across cracked lips.
Keep moving,
says August, taking Marlena's elbow and steering her firmly toward a table in the center of the tent. It's not our usual table, but I've noticed that people tend not to argue with August. Marlena sits silently, looking occasionally at the men outside the tent.
Oh, it's no good,
she says, flinging her cutlery to the table.
I can't eat with those poor souls out there.
She stands and picks up her plate.
Where are you going?
August says sharply. Marlena stares down at him.
How am I supposed to sit here and eat when they've had nothing for 2 days?
You are not giving that to him, says August. Now sit down.
People from several other tables turn to look. August smiles nervously at them and leans toward Marlena.
Darling, he says urgently, I know this is hard on you, but if you give that man food, it will encourage him to hang around. And then what? Uncle Al's already made his picks. He wasn't one of them, so he's got to move on. That's all. And the sooner the better. It's for his own good. It's a kindness, really.
Marlena's eyes narrow. She sets her plate down, stabs a pork chop with her fork, and slaps it on a piece of bread. She swipes August's bread, slaps it on the other side of the pork chop, and storms off.
What do you think you're doing?
Shouts August. She walks straight to the gaunt man, picks up his hand, and plants the sandwich in it. Then she marches off to scattered applause and whistles from the working men's side of the tent. August vibrates with anger, a vein pulsing at his temple. After a moment, he rises, taking his plate. He tilts its contents into the trash and leaves. I stare at my plate. It's piled high with pork chops, collard greens, mashed potatoes, and baked apples. I work like a dog all day, but I can't eat a thing.
Although it's nearly 7, the sun is still high and the air heavy. The terrain is very different from what we left behind in the northeast. It's flat here, and dry as a bone. The lot is covered in long grass, but it's brown and trampled, crispy as hay. At the edges, near the tracks, tall weeds have taken over. Tough plants with stringy stalks. Small leaves and compact flowers, designed to waste energy on nothing but getting their blooms up toward the sun. As I pass the stable tent, I see Kinko standing in its scant shade. Queenie squats in front of him, defecating loosely, scooching a few inches forward after each fresh burst of liquid. "What's up?" I say, coming to a stop beside him. Kinko glares at me.
"What the hell does it look like?"
"She's got the trots."
"What did she eat?"
"Who the fuck knows?"
I step forward and peer closely at one of the small puddles, checking for signs of parasites. She seems clear. "See if the cookhouse has any honey."
"Huh?"
Kinko says, straightening up and squinting at me.
"Honey. If you can get a hold of any slippery elm powder, add a bit of that as well. But a spoonful of honey should help on its own," I say.
He frowns at me for a moment, arms akimbo.
"Okay,"
he says doubtfully, and turns back to his dog. I walk on, eventually settling on a patch of grass some distance from the Fox Brothers menagerie. It stands in ominous desertion, as though there's a minefield around it. No one comes within 20 yards. The conditions inside must be deadly, but short of tying up Uncle Al in August and hijacking the water wagon, I can't think of a damn thing to do. I grow more and more desperate until I can sit still no longer. I climb to my feet and go instead to our menagerie. Even with the benefit of full water troughs and a cross breeze, the animals are in a heat-induced stupor. Zebras, giraffes, and other hay burners remain on their feet, but with their necks extended and eyes half closed. Even the yak is motionless, despite the flies that buzz mercilessly around his ears and eyes. I swat a few away, but they land again immediately. It's hopeless. The polar bear lies on his stomach, head and snout stretched in front of him. In repose, he looks harmless, cuddly even, with most of his bulk concentrated in the lower third of his body. He takes a deep, halting breath, and then exhales a long, rumbling groan. Poor thing. I doubt the temperature in the Arctic ever climbs anywhere close to this. The orangutan lies flat on her back, arms and legs spread out. She turns her head to look at me, blinking mournfully as though apologizing for not making more of an effort. "It's okay," I say with my eyes. "I understand." She blinks once more, and then turns her face so she's looking at the ceiling again. When I get to Marlena's horses, they snort in recognition and flap their lips against my hands, which still smell like baked apples. When they find I have nothing for them, they lose interest and drift back into their semi-conscious state. The cats lie on their sides, perfectly still, their eyes not quite closed. If it weren't for the steady rise and fall of their rib cages, I might think they were dead. I press my forehead up against the bars and watch them for a long time. Finally, I turn to leave. I'm about 3 yards away when I suddenly turn back. It's just dawned on me that the floors of their dens are conspicuously clean. Marlena and August are arguing so loudly I can hear them 20 yards off. I pause outside her dressing tent, not at all sure I want to interrupt, but neither do I want to listen. I finally steel myself and press my mouth to the flap. "August! Hey, August!" The voices drop. There's a shuffling and someone shushing someone.
"What is it?"
calls August.
"Did Clive feed the cats?"
His face appears in the crack of the flap.
"Ah, yes. Well, that presented a bit of difficulty, but I've worked something out."
"What?"
"It's coming tomorrow morning. Don't worry. They'll be fine."
"Oh, Lord," he says, craning his neck to see beyond me.
"What now?"
Uncle Al strides toward us in red waistcoat and top hat. his plaid, swaddled legs swallowing the ground. His grovelers follow, jogging in nervous spurts to keep up. August sighs and holds the flap open for me.
You might as well come in and have a seat. Looks like you're about to get your first business lesson.
I duck inside. Marlena sits at her vanity, her arms folded and legs crossed. Her foot jiggles in anger.
My dear, says August, collect yourself.
Marlena, says Uncle Al from just behind the tent flap. Marlena, may I come in, dear? I need a word with August.
Marlena smacks her lips and rolls her eyes.
Yes, Uncle Al. Of course, Uncle Al. Won't you please come in, Uncle Al? She intones.
The tent flap opens and Uncle Al enters, perspiring visibly and beaming from ear to ear.
The deal is done, he says, coming to a stop in front of August.
So you got him then, says August.
Huh? What?
Replies Uncle Al, blinking in surprise.
The freak, says August. Charles, what's it?
No, never mind about him.
What do you mean, never mind about him, says August. I thought he was the whole reason we came here. What happened?
What?
Says Uncle Al vaguely. Heads pop out from behind him, shaking vehemently. One man makes the motion of slitting his throat. August looks at them and sighs.
Oh... Ringling got him.
Never mind that, says Uncle Al. I've got news. Big news. You might even say jumbo-size news.
He looks back at his followers and is met with hearty guffaws. He swings around again.
Guess.
I have no idea, Al, says August.
He turns expectantly toward Marlena.
I don't know, she says crossly.
We scored a bull.
Uncle Al shouts, spreading his arms wide in jubilation. His cane smacks a groveler who leaps backward. August's face freezes.
What?
A bull. An elephant.
You have an elephant?
No, August, you have an elephant. Her name is Rosie. She's 53, and she's perfectly brilliant. The best bull they had. I can't wait to see the act you come up with.
He closes his eyes, the better to summon up an image. His fingers wriggle in front of his face. He smiles in closed-eyed ecstasy.
I'm thinking it involves Marlena. She can ride her during the parade in Grand Spec. And then you can follow with a feature act in the center ring. Oh, here.
He turns around and snaps his fingers.
Where is it? Come on, you idiots.
A bottle of champagne appears. He presents it for Marlena's inspection with a deep bow. Then he unwinds the wire top and pops the cork. Fluted glasses appear from somewhere behind him and are set up on Marlena's vanity. Uncle Al pours a small amount into each and passes one to Marlena, August, and me. He lifts the final one high. His eyes mist over. He sighs deeply and clasps a hand to his breast.
It is my great pleasure to celebrate this momentous occasion with you, my dearest friends in the world.
He rocks forward on his spatted feet and squeezes out a real tear. It rolls over his fat cheek.
Not only do we have a veterinarian, and a Cornell-educated one at that, we have a bull. A bull!
He sniffs with happiness and pauses, overcome.
I have waited for this day for years. And this is just the beginning, my friends. We are in the big leagues now. A show to be reckoned with.
There is scattered clapping from behind him. Marlena balances her glass on her knee. August holds his stiffly in front of him. Except for grasping the glass, he hasn't moved a muscle. Uncle Al thrusts his champagne into the air.
To the Benzini Brothers' most spectacular show on earth, he shouts.
Benzini Brothers, cry voices from behind him.
Marlena and August are silent. Al drains his glass and tosses it to the nearest member of his entourage, who drops it into a jacket pocket and follows Al from the tent. The flap closes, and once again it's just the three of us. There is a moment of utter stillness, Then August's head jerks, as though he's coming to.
I guess we better go see this rubber mule, he says, draining his glass in a single gulp. Jacob, you can see to those damned animals now, you happy?
I look at him, wide-eyed. Then I also drain my glass. From the corner of my eye, I see Marlena do the same.
The Fox Brothers' menagerie is now swarming with Benzini Brothers' men. They run back and forth, filling troughs, tossing hay, and hauling away dung. Some sections of sidewall have been raised, creating a cross breeze. I scan the tent as we enter, looking for animals in distress. Fortunately, they all look very much alive. The elephant looms against the far sidewall, an enormous beast the color of storm clouds. We push through the workmen and stop in front of her. She is gargantuan, at least 10 feet tall at the shoulder. Her skin is mottled and cracked like a scorched riverbed from the tip of her trunk all the way down to her wide feet. Only her ears are smooth. She peers out at us with eerily human eyes. They're amber, set deep in her head, and fringed with outrageously long lashes.
Good God, says August.
Her trunk reaches out to us, moving like an independent creature. It waves in front of August, then Marlena, and finally me. At the end of it, a finger-like protrusion wiggles and grasps. The nostrils open and close, snuffing and blowing, and then the trunk retreats. It swings in front of her like a pendulum, an enormous and muscled worm. Its finger grasps stray pieces of hay from the ground and then drops them again. I watch the swaying trunk and wish it would come back. I hold my hand out in offering, but it doesn't return. August stares in consternation and Marlena simply stares. I don't know what to think. I've never encountered an animal this large. She rises almost 4 feet above my head.
You the bull man? Says a man approaching from the right. His shirt is filthy and untucked, puffing out from behind his suspenders.
I am the equestrian director and superintendent of animals, replies August, drawing himself up to full height. Where's your bull man? Says the man, squirting a wad of tobacco juice from the corner of his mouth.
The elephant reaches out with her trunk and taps him on the shoulder. He whacks her and steps out of reach.
The elephant opens her shovel-shaped mouth in what can only be described as a smile and starts to sway, keeping time with the movement of her trunk.
Why do you want to know? Says August.
Just want a word with him is all.
Why?
To let him know what he's in for, says the man.
How do you mean?
Show me your bull man and I'll tell you.
August grabs my arm and swings me forward.
Him! This is my bull man. So what are we in for?
The man looks at me, pushes his wad of tobacco deep in his cheek, and continues to address August.
This here's the stupidest goddamn animal on the face of the earth.
August looks stunned.
I thought she was supposed to be the best bull. Al said she was the best bull.
The man snorts and squirts a stream of brown saliva toward the great beast.
If she was the best bull, why was she the only one left?
You think you're the first show to turn up picking the bones? You didn't even get here for 3 days. Well, good luck on you. He turns to leave.
Wait,
August says quickly.
Tell me more. Is she a rogue?
No.
Just dumb as a bag of hammers. Where did she come from?
An elephant tramp. Some dirty Polack who dropped dead in Libertyville.
City gave her up for a song.
Wasn't no bargain, though,
'cause she ain't done a damn thing since but eat.
August stares at him pale.
You mean she wasn't even with a circus?
The man steps over the rope and disappears behind the elephant. He returns with a wooden rod about 3 feet long with a 4-inch metal pick coming off the end.
Here's your bull hook. You're gonna need it. Good luck on you. As for me, if I never see another bull as long as I live, it'll be too soon.
He spits again and walks away. August and Marlena stare after him. I look back just in time to see the elephant pull her trunk from the trough. She lifts it, aims, and blasts the man with such force his hat sails off his head on a stream of water. He stops, his hair and clothes dripping. He's still for a moment, then he wipes his face, leans over to retrieve his hat, bows to the astonished audience of menagerie workers, and continues on his way.
Chapter 10.
August huffs and puffs and turns so red he's actually closer to purple. Then he marches off, presumably to have it out with Uncle Al. Marlena and I glance at each other. By unspoken agreement, neither of us follows. One by one, the menagerie men leave. The animals, finally fed and watered, settle in for the night. At the end of a desperate day is peace. Marlena and I are alone, holding various bits of foodstuff toward Rosie's inquisitive trunk, when its strange, rubbery finger grabs a wisp of hay from my fingers. Marlena squeals with laughter. Rosie tosses her head and opens her mouth in a smile. I turn to find Marlena staring at me. The only sounds from within the menagerie are shuffling, snorting, and quiet munching. Outside in the distance, someone plays a harmonica. A haunting tune in triple time, although I can't place it. I'm not sure how it happens. Do I reach for her? Does she reach for me? But the next thing I know, she's in my arms and we're waltzing, dipping and skipping in front of the low-slung rope. As we twirl, I catch sight of Rosie's raised trunk and smiling face. Marlena pulls suddenly away. I stand motionless, my arms still slightly raised, unsure what to do. Says Marlena, blushing furiously and looking at everything but me. Well, yes, let's go wait for August, shall we? I stare at her for a long moment. I want to kiss her. I want to kiss her more than I've ever wanted anything in my life. Yes, I finally say. Yes, let's. An hour later, August returns to the stateroom. He storms in and slams the door. Marlena goes immediately to a cupboard.
That useless son of a bitch paid $2,000 for that useless son of a bitch bull, he says, throwing his hat in the corner and ripping off his jacket. 2,000 fucking clams!
He flops into the nearest chair and drops his head into his hands. Marlena removes a bottle of blended whiskey, pauses, looks at August, and then puts it back. She reaches for the single malt instead.
And that's not the worst of it.
Oh, no, says August, ripping his tie loose and clawing at his shirt collar.
You want to know what else he did? Hmm? Go on, guess.
He's looking at Marlena, who is utterly unperturbed. She pours a good 4 fingers worth of whiskey into 3 tumblers.
I said guess, barks August.
I don't know, I'm sure, Marlena says calmly. She puts the cap back on the whiskey.
He's spent the rest of the money on a goddamn elephant car.
Marlena turns, suddenly paying attention.
He didn't pick up any performers?
Sure he did.
But?
Yes, exactly,
says August, cutting her off. Marlena hands him a glass, motions me over for mine, and then takes a seat. I take a slug and wait as long as I can.
Yes, well, both of you may know what the hell you're talking about, but I don't. Do you mind filling me in?
August exhales through puffed cheeks and brushes away the shock of hair that has fallen across his forehead. He leans forward, his elbows on his knees. Then he lifts his face so his eyes are locked on mine.
It means, Jacob, that we hired more people without having anywhere to put them. It means, Jacob, that Uncle Al has seized one of the working men's bunk cars and declared it a performer's sleeping car. And because he hired 2 women, he has to partition it. It means, Jacob, that in order to accommodate less than 12 performers, we will now have 64 working men sleeping under wagons on the flats.
That's stupid, I say. He should just fill the bunk car with whoever needs a bunk.
He can't do that, says Marlena. Why not?
because you can't mix working men and performers.
Isn't that exactly what Kinko and I are doing?
Ha!
August snorts and sits forward, a lopsided smirk etched on his face.
Do tell us, please. I'm dying to know. How's that going?
He cocks his head and smiles. Marlena takes a deep breath and crosses her legs. A moment later, that red leather shoe starts pumping up and down. I throw my whiskey down my throat and leave. It was a big whiskey, and it starts to take effect somewhere between the staterooms and the coaches. I'm clearly not the only one under the influence either. Now that business has been concluded, everyone connected with the Benzini Brothers' most spectacular show on Earth is letting off steam. The gatherings run the entire gamut from celebratory soirees characterized by radio jazz and outbursts of laughter to the desultory gatherings of dirty men who huddle some distance from the train and pass around various types of intoxicant. I catch sight of Camel, who lifts a hand in greeting before passing along the sterno fluid. I hear thrashing in the long grass and pause to investigate. I see a woman's bare legs spread wide with a man between them. He grunts and ruts like a billy goat. His trousers are down around his knees, his hairy buttocks pumping up and down. She grasps his shirt in her fists, moaning with each thrust. It takes me a moment to realize what I'm looking at. When I do, I wrench my eyes away and wobble forward. As I approach the ring stock car, I see people sitting on the open doorway and milling around outside. There are even more inside. Kinko is lording over a party with a bottle in his hand and drunken hospitality on his face. When he catches sight of me, he trips and lurches forward. Hands reach out to catch him. "Jacob, my man," he shouts, his eyes fiercely bright. He shakes free of his friends and straightens up. "Folks? Friends?" He calls across the crowd of about 30 people who take up the space usually occupied by Marlena's horses. He walks over and places his arm around my waist. "This is my dear, dear friend Jacob." He pauses to take a swig from the bottle. "Please, make him welcome," he says, "as a favor to me." His guests whistle and laugh. Kinko laughs until he coughs. He lets go of my waist and waves his hand in front of his purple face until he stops sputtering. Then he throws his arm around the waist of the man next to us. They stagger off. Since the goat room is jammed tight, I head for the other end of the car, where Silver Star used to reside, and slump down against the slatted wall. The pile of straw next to me rustles. I reach out and poke it, hoping I won't find a rat. Queenie's white tail stump is visible for only a moment before she burrows further into the straw, like a crab in sand. From here on in, I'm not entirely sure of the order. Bottles are passed to me, and I'm pretty sure I drink from most of them. Before long, things are swimming, and I'm filled with the warmth of human kindness toward everyone and everything. People have their arms around my shoulders, and I have mine around theirs. We laugh uproariously. At what, I don't remember. But everything is a riot. There's some game where you have to toss something, and if you miss the target, you have to take a drink. I miss quite a lot. Eventually, I begin to think I'm going to throw up and crawl away, to the great mirth of everyone. I'm sitting in the corner. I can't quite remember getting here, but I'm leaning against the wall with my head resting on my knees. I do so wish the world would stop spinning, but it doesn't. So I try leaning my head back against the wall instead.
"Well now, what have we here?"
says a sultry voice from somewhere nearby. My eyes pop open. A foot's length of tightly packed cleavage is directly under my nose. I run my eyes up it until I see a face. It's Barbara. I blink quickly, trying to see only one of her. Oh, God, it's no use. But no, wait. It's okay. It's not multiple Barbaras. It's multiple women.
"Hi, honey,"
says Barbara, reaching out and stroking my face.
You doing okay?
Mm-hmm, I say, trying to nod. Her fingertips linger under my chin as she turns to the blonde crouching beside her.
So young. Oh, he's cute as a button, isn't he, Nell?
Nell takes a drag from a cigarette and blows the smoke from the side of her mouth.
Sure is. Don't think I've seen him before.
He was helping out at the cooch tent a few nights ago,
says Barbara. She turns back to me.
What's your name, honey?
She says softly, running the backs of her fingers up and down my cheek.
Jacob, I say, around the edges of a belch.
Jacob, she says. Oh, say, I know who you are. He's the one Walter was talking about,
she says to Nell.
He's brand new, a first of May. Handled himself real well at the cooch tent.
She grabs my chin and raises it, gazing deep into my eyes. I try to return the favor, but I'm having some trouble focusing.
Oh, you are a sweet thing. So tell me, Jacob, you ever been with a woman?
I say.
Nell giggles. Barbara leans back and puts her hands on her waist.
What do you think? Want to give him a proper welcome?
We practically have to, says Nell. A first of May and a virgin?
Her hand slips between my legs and slides over my crotch.
My head, which had been wobbling on its stem, snaps upright.
You think his hair will be red down there, too?
She says, cupping me in her palm. Barbara leans forward, unclasps my hands, and lifts one to her mouth. She turns it over, runs a long nail across the palm, and then stares me in the eye while running her tongue along the same path. Then, she takes my hand and places it on her left breast, right where the nipple must be. Oh God, I'm touching a breast. Through a dress, but still. Barbara stands up for a moment, smooths her skirt, looks furtively around, and then crouches. I'm pondering this change of position when she takes hold of my hand again. This time she pulls it under her skirt and presses my fingers against hot, moist silk. I catch my breath. The whiskey, the moonshine, the gin, the God knows what, all of it dissipates instantly. She moves my hand up and down over her strange and wonderful valleys. Oh, shit. I may come right now. She purrs, rearranging my hand so that my middle finger presses further into her. Warm silk bulges around both sides of my finger, pulsing under my touch. She removes my hand, places it back on my knee, then gives my crotch an experimental squeeze. She says, her eyes half closed.
He's ready, Nell.
Damn, I love them at this age.
The rest of the night passes in epileptic flashes. I'm aware of being propped up between two women, but I think I fall out the door of the stock car. At least I'm aware of finding myself cheek down in the dirt. Then I'm swept upward again and jostled along in the dark until I'm sitting on the edge of a bed. There are definitely two Barbaras now, and two of the other one as well. Nell, was it? Barbara steps backward and raises her arms in the air. She throws her head back and runs her hands over her body, dancing and moving by candlelight. I'm interested. There's no question about that. But I simply can't sit upright anymore, so I fall back. Someone's yanking on my pants. I mumble something, not sure what, but I don't think it's encouragement. I'm suddenly not feeling well. Oh, God. She's touching me. It. Stroking experimentally. I prop myself up on my elbows and look down. It's limp. A tiny pink turtle hiding in its shell. It also seems to be stuck to my leg. She peels it free, delves both her hands between my thighs to spread them,
and reaches down for my balls. She rests them on one hand, juggling them like eggs, while she examines my penis. It flops hopelessly under her manipulations while I watch, mortified. The other woman, now there's only one again. How the hell am I ever going to keep this straight? Lies next to me on the bed. She fishes a skinny breast from her dress and lifts it to my mouth. She rubs it all over my face. Now her lipsticked mouth is coming at me, a gaping maw with tongue extended. I turn my head to the right, where there is no woman. Then I feel a mouth close around the head of my penis. I gasp. The women giggle, but it's a purring sound, an encouraging sound, as they continue trying to get a response. Oh, God. Oh, God, she's sucking it. Sucking it, for God's sake. I'm not going to be able to. Oh, my God, I need to. I turn my head and hurl the unfortunately varied contents of my stomach onto Nell. There's a hideous scraping noise. Then the blackness above me is broken by a sliver of light.
Kinko peers in at me.
Wake up, sunshine. Your boss is looking for you.
He's holding a lid open, all of which starts to make sense, because as my cramped body realizes my brain is open for business, it soon becomes clear I'm stuffed into a trunk. Kinko props the lid open and walks away. I work my bent neck free and struggle into a sitting position. The trunk is in a tent, surrounded by rack after rack of vibrant costumes, props, and vanities with mirrors. Where am I? I croak. I cough and try to clear my parched throat.
Clown Alley,
says Kinko, fingering some paint jars on a dresser.
I lift an arm to cover my eyes and notice it is clad in silk. A red silk dressing gown, to be exact. A red silk dressing gown that is wide open. I look down and discover that someone has shaved my genitals. I snatch the edges of the gown together, wondering if Kinko saw. Dear God, what did I do last night? I have no idea. Nothing but scraps of memory and... Oh, God. I threw up on a woman. I struggle to my feet, tying the dressing gown. I wipe my forehead, which feels unusually slick. My hand comes away white. What the? I say, staring at my hand. Kinko turns and hands me a mirror. I take it with great trepidation. When I raise it to my face, a clown looks back at me. I poke my head out of the tent, look left and right, and then streak across to the stock car. I'm followed by guffaws and catcalls.
Woo-wee! Look at that hot mama! Hey, Fred, check out the new cooch girl!
Say, honey, got plans tonight?
I dive into the goat room and slam the door, leaning against it. I breathe heavily, listening until the laughter outside dies down. I grab a rag and wipe my face again. I rubbed it raw before I left Clown Alley, but somehow I still don't believe it's clean. I don't think any part of me will ever be clean again. And the worst part is that I don't even know what I did. I have only snippets. And as horrifying as those are, it's even more horrifying not knowing what happened in between. It suddenly occurs to me that I have no idea whether I'm still a virgin. I reach inside the dressing gown and scratch my stubbly balls. Kinko comes in a few minutes later. I'm lying on my bedroll, my arms over my head.
You better get your ass out there, he says. He's still looking for you.
Something snuffles in my ear. I lift my head and bang into a wet nose. Queenie leaps backward as though launched from a catapult. She surveys me from a distance of 3 feet, sniffing cautiously. Oh, I bet I'm just a medley of smells this morning. I drop my head again.
You want to get fired or what?
Kinko says. At this point, I really don't care, I mumble.
What?
I'm leaving anyway.
What the hell are you talking about?
I can't answer. I can't tell him that not only have I disgraced myself beyond belief or redemption, but I have also failed at my first opportunity to have sex, something I've thought about pretty much constantly for the last 8 years, not to mention throwing up on one of the women who was offering, and then passing out and having somebody shave my balls, paint my face, and stuff me into a trunk. Although he must have known at least parts of it, since he knew where to find me this morning. Perhaps he was even involved in the festivities.
"Don't be a pussy," he says. "You want to end up walking the tracks like those poor bums out there? Now get on out there before you get yourself fired."
I remain inert.
"I said get up."
"What do you care?" I grumble. "And stop shouting, my head hurts."
"Just get the hell up or I'll hurt the rest of you too."
"All right, just stop yelling." I drag myself upright and throw him a dirty look. My head pounds and it feels as though lead weights are tied to each of my joints. Since he continues watching me, I turn toward the wall, keeping the red gown on until I pull my pants up in an effort to hide my hairlessness. Nevertheless, my face burns.
"Oh, and a word to the wise," says Kinko. "Some flowers for Barbara wouldn't go amiss. The other one's just a whore, but Barbara's a friend."
I am so flooded with shame, my consciousness flickers. After the urge to faint passes, I stare at the ground. Sure, I'll never bring myself to look anyone in the eyes again. The Fox Brothers train has been moved off the siding, and the hotly disputed elephant car is now hitched directly behind our engine, where the ride will be smoothest. It has vents instead of slats, and is made of metal. The boys from the flying squadron are busy tearing down tents. They've already dropped most of the larger ones, revealing the buildings of Joliet in the background. A small crowd of towners has gathered to watch the activity. I find August in the menagerie tent, standing in front of the elephant.
"Move!" he screams, waving the bull hook around her face.
She swings her trunk and blinks.
"I said move!"
He steps behind her and thwacks her in the back of the leg.
"Move, goddammit!"
Her eyes narrow and her enormous ears flatten against her head. August catches sight of me and freezes. He drops the bull hook to his side.
"Rough night," he sneers.
A blush prickles up the back of my neck and spreads over my entire head.
"Never mind. Get a stick and help me move this stupid beast."
Pete comes up behind him, twisting his hat in his hands. "August?" August turns furious.
"Oh, for Christ's sake, what is it, Pete? Can't you see I'm busy?"
"The cat meat is here."
"Good. Take care of it. We don't have much time."
"What exactly do you want me to do with it?"
"What the hell do you think I want you to do with it?"
"But, boss," says Pete, clearly distressed.
"God damn it,"
says August. The vein on his temple bulges dangerously.
"Do I have to do every damn thing myself? Here," he says, thrusting the bull hook at me. "Teach the brute something. Anything'll do. As far as I can tell, all she knows how to do is shit and eat."
I take the bull hook and watch as he storms from the tent. I'm still staring after him when the elephant's trunk sweeps past my face, blowing warm air into my ear. I spin and find myself looking into an amber eye. It blinks at me. My gaze shifts from that eye to the bull hook in my hand. I look back up at the eye and again it blinks. I lean over and lay the bull hook on the ground. She swings her trunk across the ground in front of her, fanning her ears like enormous leaves. Her mouth opens in a smile.
"Hi," I say. "Hi, Rosie. I'm Jacob."
After a moment's hesitation, I extend my hand just a bit. The trunk whooshes past, blowing. Emboldened, I reach out and lay a hand on her shoulder. Her skin is rough and stubbly and surprisingly warm.
"Hi,"
I say again, giving her an experimental pat. Her windsail of an ear moves forward and then back, and the trunk returns. I touch it tentatively and then stroke it. I am entirely enamored and so engrossed that I don't see August until he comes to an abrupt stop in front of me.
What the hell is wrong with you people this morning? I should fire every goddamn one of you. What with Pete not wanting to take care of business and you pulling a disappearing act